Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00073. Recorded on March 13, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Bones of Contention, Part 1. Bones of Contention, Part 1. Chapter 73.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Coming to you live, recorded in the F-150 Mobile Studio. This here is Host Harlan Monologics, and I am your host, Maverick 88. Lately, I have been speaking very much to this philosophy of mine, right? This idea of mine that there is an additional season that occurs here in Texas that likely does not occur where you live, right? And what I call it is the season of the ugly scape, right? The ugly scape. And very briefly, what that is Texas has springtime temperatures that occur in it long before calendar spring actually appears, right? So winter ends when the temperatures in Texas start shooting up into the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, which frequently will happen in February, right? In fact, it happened that way this year. February, right around Valentine's, mid-February, we were already up in the 70s, and that was the end of it. There would be no more winter after that, right? And you could tell. You could tell when the temperatures get like that, they start to hold. You might have one or two attempts by cold fronts from Colorado try to push through, and they usually just don't. They kind of fizzle out. They may give you a day of rain or some shit like that, but that's it. That's like the dying gasps, the dying whimpers of winter. Going away, right? But so that season comes, say it happens around February 14th, like Valentine's Day, like I said, in this example. But spring on the calendar isn't until what? March 21st. So you've got a month, possibly more than a month, of time that is neither spring nor winter, really. And I call it the ugly scape. And that is because a lot, like the grasses will remain dormant. The trees will still be bare. The only things that'll be growing all of a sudden in massive proliferation are the weeds of every sort, right? Weeds just start going crazy and you can't not see them because they're green where everything else is brown and gray, right? And it just looks ugly. Everything just looks ugly for that. The air feels great and the warm air is welcome, but you just have that space and time. Like, we're past that right now. We're still technically a week away from calendar spring, but the trees have already leafed up, you know. They're budding or they already have full leaves on them in various cases, you know. The wildflowers have not quite yet begun. Well, the first vestiges, I had a whole three-part episode very recently, right, about dandelions. Those are the actual ugly common dandelions. Now we're starting to get the Texas dandelions, which I regard more as a wildflower. They're actually pretty. They're not an eyesore. Their color is like neon yellow. It's really cool, right? you start to see them, and then you'll start to see evening primrose, little white, little pink, like to the ground, almost like ground cover wildflowers. Those are usually the first technical wildflowers to appear, but they will appear shortly after these Texas dandelions start to sprout, right? So we're coming into calendar spring, and calendar spring things are already happening and in place. We're really past the ugliest part of the uglyscape season, but anyway, that's what I'm talking about, the ugly season. So, but when you get into this uglyscape season in Texas, you're also getting into the Lent season, the Lenten season in Holy Orthodoxy, right? The Eastern Christianity. And what Lent is, well, how do you even describe what Lent is? We call it Great Lent, and it's really, its meaning is Great 40 Days or the Great Fast. It's a 40-day fast, literally a season, you know, that we go through. And it's not a fast like I fast. You ever hear me talking about fasting? My fasting is like I starve, right? I drink coffee, I drink water, and nothing else goes into my body. Occasionally, maybe like a ibuprofen or something if I'm achy, you know, from work, or I got a headache or something, which is not really all that common with me anyway. But basically, I don't eat anything when I'm fasting, and that could be a day, that could be 3 days, that could be 5 days, that could be almost 2 weeks. That's what I've done in the past couple of years, right? And that's how I go. And usually, I fast like that at a minimum of 4 days out of every week. It's 4 or 5 days, sometimes more, that I just don't eat food, right? And that's just kind of how I roll. This fast, the Lent fast, is more of a restrictive type. Now, the Roman Catholics do it also, but they do a different version. They do a Western version of it, and that's where you kind of pick and choose what you're going to sacrifice, what you're going to, quote-unquote, give up for the Lent period, right? And their Lent actually started like a month ago, right? Our Orthodox calendar and our Easter is going to be like at the beginning of May. It's very late this year, very late. So our Lent is starting late, too. Normally, it would have started back in February at some time. But nope, not this year. It's starting late in March, and it's going to carry us into the beginning of May. Anyway, what it is a prelude up to the, what you would call in the West, Easter, right? We call in the East, Pascha, P-A-S-C-H-A, Pascha, which is a word that's relative to Passover, right? Passover, as the ancient Israelites used to celebrate Passover, which is a big deal. Big deal. It's it remains a big deal to this day in Christianity, right? Which I believe is the ancient faith, not only back to the apostles, but all the way back to Abel in the garden, right? That's a whole nother conversation. In fact, that's a whole nother book that I am in the process of writing, okay? It's some heavy thinking in there, but we won't get that heavy here in this audio podcast, at least not this time around. Lent for the Orthodox differs from that of the Romans, Roman Catholicism, in that we don't really do a la carte selective sacrifice, right? Or restriction, whichever word you want to use. The whole church does the same thing. There's a fast, there's a restriction, which is basically no meat, right? No meat for 40 days. Whereas with the Pope's church, you have, you might decide, I'm not going to smoke for Lent. I'm not going to eat chocolate for Lent. You know, I'll not eat beef, but I could still eat pork and chicken. Right, it becomes very personal and whatever. I don't mean to debate that here. I'm not. I'm just saying what the differences are. But I'm preparing to not have any meat for 40 days. I don't know. You prepare for that. You don't. You know. You just when Lent starts, you just don't eat meat anymore. Right. 40 days go by, and because I don't eat most days of the week. It's really not, I've done it, right? It's not that big a deal. In fact, what's really fascinating about it is when I first entered into Orthodoxy and I was hearing about this Lent, and I was hearing about this 40-day meat restriction, I was in a quandary, right? There's a funny word for you, a quandary. What was my quandary, you may ask? My quandary was like this. I had been a person with diabetes, right, for one thing, and also heart disease. I was starting into liver problems. I had some physical problems, and the way I dealt with it was not with medications and not with surgery, doctors, and all that medical stuff. I kind of had this, let's just call it a conversation with God, an ongoing conversation with God, where He was kind of directing me how to eat and how not to eat day by day over a period of, you know, like 5 or 6 years, as it was up to that point in time, that actually controlled the diabetes, for example, right? And actually the heart disease. All my valves and all my arteries cleared out. I had a heart attack 12 years ago. And I went into a cardiologist, last summer, the summer before? I was almost completely devoid of any kind of the buildup or blockage in my arteries or around my heart, which was unfathomable. He was bewildered by the whole thing, and frankly, quite embarrassed, because he recommended me getting scoped out, and I was completely clear, right? No worries. And this all happened through this particular sort of, you could call it fasting, that I came to as a result of my spirituality, right? My ongoing conversation and prayer with God, of speaking and listening and following through. I did not want to go into Lent and change everything and get away from what God had me personally doing, right? So we had this conundrum. God was personally guiding me. At the same time, He's corporately guiding the Apostolic Church, the Orthodox Church, and something had to give to make me, you know, fit in with what was going on. My priest convinced me to give it a try. And when I gave it a try, what happened was nothing. I didn't have blood sugar problems. I didn't have heart problems. And I went through a Lent season, and it occurred to me that my diabetes was gone. That's when I started to realize that my heart problems were gone too. It would just take some time before I actually went to a cardiologist and proved that out. But the original concern was the diabetes. If I just start eating anything that isn't meat, now I'm putting all these carbs and all these sugars and all this crap. This is the sort of thing I was avoiding all that time, right? I start putting that into my body. My blood sugar is going to go crazy. Then I'm going to need medication. What do I do, you know? My priest, through prayer, I think, resolved it. I think he, like I said before, a righteous person, the power of a righteous person's prayer can have such great impact on this world. And the Bible says so too, right? It says so in the Bible. I believe it's the letter of James, to be specific, right? Talks about that. I believe that my priest went to the Lord in prayer over me and my situation, and the result of it was that my health problems were washed away as I was willing to join in with what was going on with the church. And to this day, which has now been, it's been a couple of years now since this happened, I eat whatever the hell I want. Ask my wife. She has watched me take like the whole half gallon of Blue Bonnet. I get a chocolate chip Blue Bonnet ice cream periodically, right? And go from the top to the bottom within like a 6-hour period and not have a blood sugar spike. What the hell is that? Where did that come from? Who do you know that's been cured of diabetes in their lifetime? Incredible. And I bring it up here every once in a while because still it's incredible to me, right? So I bring up all that stuff. Why now? Because there is miraculous power with the things of the ancient faith. I've already encountered what I consider to be miraculous, maybe semi-miraculous, small little scale occurrences and observations in my short, my relatively short time as an Orthodox Christian compared to all the years I spent as a Protestant, and of course in my childhood when I was a reluctant Roman Catholic. I could speak to these things because I've been these things. I've been baptized basically in all three of these general variants of Christianity, right? So I'm not like joining in somebody's debate. I'm not arguing against somebody else's concept. I've lived these things from the inside out and made my decisions to stay or go, right? What's real, what's not real. So Lent, here we go, right? We're going into the Lent season. I believe it's this coming Monday it begins, technically, possibly Sunday night. I don't know. I'm not really technical about it. This is not a matter of legalism, right? We're not about litigiousness when it comes to this. This is about the church suffering the same thing simultaneously, collectively as a group for the same period of time. We all make the same sacrifice. We live the same thing. And see, this is something that has occurred to me, right? Like, I'm not a religious person. I'm really not. I'm all about the faith and the spirituality, and I've got that quote-unquote conscious contact with God, and I've been kind of operating my Christianity to the beat of my own drum like any good Protestant would do, right? But I'm doing it within the scope of Orthodox belief, and I see how my mindset has shifted from that Western mind to the Eastern mind through my days as an Orthodox Christian. My perspective has changed. That's part of the miracle that's going on, right? So much of the miracle nature, the miraculous nature of the ancient faith, the ancient church, seems to occur like within the bounds of the collective. You know, I hate to think of it as like the hive mind, like what you saw with the Borg in Star Trek, right? There is some kind of collective that we share in that binds us together, right? And it actually certifies church unity when we do these kind of practices in what? Unison, right? In unison. So what's happening here at Lent is that we all kind of share in the same, not kind of, we all share in the same restriction. We all share in the same sacrifice. And actually, it goes over further than that. We start to share in the same labor. What do I mean by that? Because when you take meat out of a diet, and you can ask the vegetarians and the vegans this, right? You can go crazy trying to concoct meals because so many things incorporate meat somehow. You know, oh, I can't eat a steak. Well, all right, we'll just go out and get pizza. Wait a minute. Cheese, dairy, can't have that either. You see what I'm saying? It just gets to being like that. And when you're used to, you're not a vegan, you're not a vegetarian, you're used to eating meat, then coming up with, like, I don't have this problem so much, right, as other people do, because like I say, I do not eat at all 4 or 5 days out of the week, and when I finally do come to eat, I'm hungry. I'm really hungry, and I can eat just about anything, right? But for people who stick to their three meals a day with a snack somewhere in the afternoon and a midnight snack, ordinary, you know, get my ass fat American schedule of eating, it becomes really difficult to not get sick and tired of eating what seems to be the same thing over and over again, right? So what ends up happening is like you confer with one another, like recipes, things that you can do, you know, for another meal. And it gets worse because like I got me to deal with and I got my wife to deal with, but we don't have the kids, right? So it's between us to figure it out. But then when you have kids involved, little children, they're not down with this. Now, if they're raised this way, you know, from the cradle, it becomes a pattern of their life. And they don't like it. but it's some sort of normal to them. If you're a convert with kids, I can only imagine how much bedlam there is in a household for those 40 days over all the food stuff, you know? And so we all share in all these things related to Lent. And at some psychic level, it makes us all closer to one another. It unifies us. And the biggest problem with, you know, quote unquote Christianity, the Christian faith as a whole, is the division within. And all the division comes from a point of origin that I call orthodoxy, right? This is the ancient faith. This is the apostolic faith. This is how it all began. And everything that's split off from it, split off from it, right? This is the origin. So if you ever had the notion of unifying the church, or at least becoming part of the process of unifying the church, the only thing you can do is go back to the beginning. Do not be a part of all the different splits and divides and denominations. Go back to the beginning, get involved. That was a major impetus for me to actually take a good hard look at orthodoxy, and then, having found what I would come to find, being resolved to become a part of it. I believe, right? Fascinating stuff. So now here we are, approaching Lent, right? So it's like last call for meat. You know, and for a carnivore like me, and I am indeed a heavy carnivore, always been. At some level, I've got it in my head, like the more I can gorge on hunks of beef and pork and chicken now, the easier it will be to hold over for 40 days, when that's absolutely bullshit. That is not reality at all. That's not realistic at all, right? But still, there's that desire to just... It's kind of like smoke them if you got them, you know? Here's a chance to eat meat. You're not going to have this chance for a while. So let's go big, right? So I already got the idea in my head that perhaps this weekend, which looks like it may be another washout. We haven't had a washout in a couple of weekends. I got worked out this past weekend. I may get into that later on. But we haven't had a washout for a couple weekends, and we've had some nice, good weather and pleasant times. You know, I've mentioned that earlier in previous episodes. So the last call for meat, I automatically think, all right, let's go. We're in Texas. Let's go to a steakhouse. And the first steakhouse I think of is Texas Roadhouse, right? Because it's Texas. It's Roadhouse, steakhouse. We have one in our town nearby. And it was the place where my wife and I went on our very, very first date. Right? Went on our very first date. And so we go there fairly frequently throughout the course of the year. And as fate would have it, because God's got his hands all over everything in our lives all the time, right? She gets upwards of like $300 a year, like at the holiday season, in gift cards for Texas Roadhouse. So we eat like kings and queens for free many times, well, several times a year. And then we may even go back and pay out of our own pockets. Like, the place is good. It's a chain. You know, do not be mistaken. It's a definite chain. In fact, Texas Roadhouse ain't even a Texas thing, right? You think, all right, I'm going to post-Arlen Monologics deals very much with Texas stuff in the 21st century. And when Maverick 88 brings Texas Roadhouse into the story, you're going to get a background on a Texas institution. And the fact is, no, that's bullshit. That is not the truth. Texas Roadhouse was actually founded in Indiana in the early 90s, like 1992 or something like that, right? Somebody had a business interest, an idea of bringing some kind of like Colorado, like Rocky Mountain type of fare into a restaurant, which could be developed as a chain. And a couple of people partnered up with it. It didn't work out. They split, and one off and did something else, and one did this. They came up with this idea of a Texas-style steakhouse instead.
And yeah, so it's an Indiana thing. And incidentally, the first time I ever had any experience with Texas Roadhouse whatsoever was in, drumroll please, Indiana. Yeah, Indiana. What the hell was I doing in Indiana? It was 03 or 04, right? 2003 or 2004. I was working for a major Fortune 100 transportation company out of Georgia. At the time, I was still on a project up in Jersey, right? A chemical company up in Jersey. And I was sent out to Indianapolis to our client's main site, main production site. I worked at their headquarters in Jersey. They had a massive production site in Indianapolis. And when I got to Indy, I met up with the project manager who worked out of Georgia. He was actually a Brooklyn guy that had moved down to the Atlanta area. And I got stories with him from later on when I ended up moving to Georgia. He's a good guy. I liked him. I have fond memories of this dude, right? But I was to meet up with him. We were spending a couple of days basically just touring the plant. It wasn't even really work. It was kind of weird to me that they would even involve me in this. But they did, right? They sent me out, and there must have been some kind of ulterior motive behind it that never came to light for some reason. I don't know. I can't even speculate at this point on what that was. But I met this project manager in Indianapolis. We had another person on our project who worked on site there. He was a specialist in train transportation, right? We were doing this transportation project. He was our train guide. He was an Indianapolis guy. He was there on site. We spent 2 or 3 days with him, just kind of touring the facility, and then, you know, breaking off and answering emails and things like that. Not really working. And then me and the project manager hopped in a rental car, and we drove basically, what, halfway, three-quarters of the way across the state to, like, the southwest corner of Indiana, to Evansville, right? On the way to Evansville, it was nighttime. Frankly, the guy was paranoid because I was driving like a maniac. It was just wide open road. I was probably doing like 80 or 90 in a rental car, and I really just didn't give a shit. And we were in no particular hurry. It's just, it was a wide open road. And he just, you know, somewhere along the way, he came up with the idea that we should probably pull over and eat, right? And when we were done eating, he would pick up and drive. So we pulled over and eat. Where we went to was somewhere between Indianapolis and Evansville, a Texas Roadhouse. Right, it's the first time I ever ate in Texas Roadhouse. It was in Indiana, and it turns out Indiana is where it all originated from. My wife and I, we frequently would go to Texas Roadhouse. It's the first thing that comes to mind when it's time to go get a steak, and it's usually where we turn to because we could so frequently get it for free, right, with all the gift cards she has. And now I'm thinking the same thing maybe for this weekend too, right? Maybe for this weekend too. In fact, we got a guy at work here who moonlights as a waiter. I think the last time or second to last time we were there, I actually saw him, and I really couldn't believe my eyes. It couldn't have been him. Nobody could work the shit job at this place and then turn around and go work somebody else and raise a family, right? He's doing it. I had a conversation with him the other day about it. It's like, you know, I was in the Texas Roadhouse, You know, I could have swore I saw you in there. This guy looked just like you. And he's like, yeah, I worked there. I've been there for a little while now. I'm like, holy shit, you know? And you know what? He's not the first one. Somebody else had been working there also for a period of time, trying to pay off child support, you know? And that's how one of the situations people get into the whole moonlight problem anyway. But not this guy. He's got just living his life, you know. He's got a house. He's paying a mortgage. A wife that works. He's got kids. And the bills are just more than this job can, and his wife's job can cover. So he's got to leave here and go work there, right? So I'd be hoping to catch him on a night where he's working so I could get one of his tables and give him a big old fat tip, you know. And I don't know if it's going to work out that way. If we go at all, we're going to go probably on Saturday. And he's not working Saturday. Not there anyway. As far as I can glean, I don't think that's the case. But yeah. And so you go, you know, we're going to break this. Well, not break, but we're going to enter into the Lent fast period with one last hurrah and get a big old porterhouse or T-bone, you know, something like that. Texas T-bone. All right, there's your actual Texas reference for the week, right? A Texas T-bone. It's a cut, right? A Texas T-bone. In fact, the T-bone and the porterhouse are both cut from the short loin on a steer, on cattle. They both include a T-shaped lumbar vertebra, right? The bone, right? The bone. That's what we're talking about here, the T and the T-bone. You got a T-shaped bone. That happens in both the porterhouse and the T-bone. There's got to be some kind of difference between the two. All right, here, the porterhouse steaks are cut from the rear end of the short loin and thus include more tenderloin steak, along with, on the other side of the bone, a large strip steak. T-bone steaks are cut closer to the front, right? So they're coming from the same portion of the animal, but that portion has a front and a rear side to it, and the porterhouse is actually the preferred and more expensive cut, and usually what I would get. However, sometimes I do just go for the Texas T-bone, right? So there's a little something. Shit, I didn't even know for sure. I didn't realize that those two cuts were so closely related, but now I understand a little bit, and so do you. Because I'm good for a little bit of something, and sometimes it's education, right? Sometimes it's that. Now, speaking of bones, right? There's all kinds of bones to speak of. First of all, I should probably just do this, right? Bear with me as I whip out the non-Maverick 88 dictionary, right? The American Heritage Online app that I drag around. And look up the word bone, right? The reason I want to do this is just in the event that somebody may be listening to this somewhere out in the, say, 22nd century, right? Looking back, say, 100 years or more, so listening to this old guy in Texas on a monologue recording that nobody listens to, he's talking about bones. But he out there in the 22nd century may actually be living in a transhumanistic era where there are no bones. Nobody knows what a bone is. Nobody's seen an animal. Nobody's eaten an animal. Nobody has bones of their own because they are transhuman. What the hell is a bone in a world like that? You wouldn't even know. I could do a whole episode on bones. You know, let's do it. Let's do a whole episode on bones, right? Since we went down this track, right? We'll do about bones. But I have to make sure that Joe 22nd century schizoid man knows what the hell we're talking about here, all right? So here, the definition of a bone, right? The dense, semi-rigid, porous, calcified connective tissue forming the major portion of the skeleton of most vertebrates. It consists of a dense organic matrix and an inorganic mineral component. Or, you might say, any of numerous anatomically distinct structures making up the skeleton of a vertebrate animal. For example, there are more than 200 different bones in the human body. In short, you could say a skeleton or skeletal remains. Okay, so that's what a bone is, in case you are from a time long in the future. So other bones that come to mind. Bones McCoy. That's a Star Trek reference, because how many times do I do that in post-Darlin monologics, right? Not as much as I used to, because I'm not watching it anymore. I was actually actively watching them for a good chunk of the time early on when I was starting this project a year ago. Well, more than a year ago, a year and a half ago. And so I was actively watching episodes of the different variants of Star Trek, and so frequently those references would come to mind. Much more infrequently now, but it does happen time to time. And the Doctor character on the original Star Trek, right, from the 1960s, was Bones McCoy, who was played by, what was it, DeForest Kelly, I think his name was. I don't know. I'm not good when it comes to that Hollywood stuff. But yeah. And Bones was actually a nickname He had an actual name, which was, drum roll please, I have no living idea. I totally forget. He's Bones McCoy. Where would you give if guy? He wasn't skinny. You know, he wasn't like out on the Serengeti scavenging for bug larvae. You know, to sustain himself for another 10 minutes. I don't know where that nickname came from. There's probably some kind of story behind it that I have not bothered to go uncover for all you all. So that's something that you can do for extra credit and come back, get back with me and let me know. But yeah, there's the Bones McCoy from Star Trek. He was the doctor who had a great contention with the Vulcan, Mr. Spock, right? They were always at each other. And it was often very funny. I found it to be very comical and very suitable comedy for that science fiction that tended towards seriousness, right? It had a degree of levity to it at times, and a lot of that levity would be the interaction between Bones McCoy and Mr. Spock. Other Bones. Well, you got smoking Bones, right? Marijuana cigarettes. In the 70s, they were called joints. In the 80s, they were called bones. They look like bones. They're white. They're straight. They're rigid. They look like little tiny, like chicken bones, basically. But they do not perform the same function, right? They do not perform the same function at all. Now, other bones, and you may actually relate this one directly to smoking bones, right? Alice in Chains. Alice in Chains, that is a grunge band from the early 90s, right? One of the major players in the grunge era, the Seattle scene. Alice in Chains. Great band. One of my favorites, right? One of my favorites. I don't know that I talk enough about Alice in Chains. I make reference to all kinds of pop culture stuff, but some of my actual favorites kind of seem to get left in the dust. I don't know. I could be wrong about that, but I don't believe I've spent much time with Alice in Chains. They had their LP called Dirt, right? Which was probably their great, not even probably, absolutely, without a doubt, their greatest effort. And they did some great things. They had some excellent albums, EPs, LPs. For as long as they were able to work with Lane Staley, the original singer of the band, who was a heroin addict, had a lot of issues. When you have those kind of issues, it's hard to like keep the band working together. There's always problems, you know, rehabs and jails and just general inability to, you know, not showing up when you're supposed to. All that kind of crap happened with Stone Temple Pilots and Scott Weiland too, right? It's nothing new. It's a part of the legends of rock and roll. You know, the history of rock and roll is just loaded with drug abuse problems, right? But when they were able to pull something together, they never did anything bad. They had a couple of silly songs on some of their albums, I thought anyway, kind of like a waste of space. But generally what they did was very, very good. And really it wasn't about Lane Staley anyway. It was always about Jerry Cantrell, the guitar player, who also did backing singing, some of the lead singing, and could really handle it all himself. Reminds me very much of a more modern David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, right? David Gilmour is really Pink Floyd. I don't care what Roger Waters got to say. David Gilmour was the principal once he came into the band. He had it all. He did it all. And there ain't no Pink Floyd as we know Pink Floyd without him. I say the same about Alice in Chains with Jerry Cantrell, right? Eventually, Lane Staley would OD, die, be found dead after rotting away in some apartment somewhere for God knows how long, weeks, you know. Horrible story, horrible ending to a troubled life. But the work they did collectively while he was alive was outstanding. I'm sure what happened after that with the new singer was good. It would never be the same, you know. Sometimes you just can't lose. Usually you cannot lose your lead singer in a band and really carry on. I mean, you can do it, but it's never really going to be the same. There are very rare examples, and I'm going to come to one later on. Right, come to one later on, talking about Bones. I could think of one exception where a band lost its singer, got a new one, and actually improved as a result of it, right? There's probably others, but one of them just comes to mind in a big way. But in the early 90s, was it 92, 91, something like that? They came out with Alice in Chains came out with their Dirt, D-I-R-T LP. It was really dark, really dark. Great cover. It had a cover. It was like a human body that had it was like half sunken into the ground. It was actually like part of the earth, right? It really just screamed of death. There were so many themes of death throughout the album. And one of them was this song, Them Bones, right? In fact, that's the lead-in song. You turn on your album, your cassette, your CD, your MP3. The first cut on this collection is called Them Bones. And, going through the lyrics, it's got the obvious themes of death. When you're talking about bones and skeletons and things like that, you're clearly talking about something that isn't alive anymore, right? In most cases. And so you got that general sense of death, and you get that general romancing of death that, stoners like me had, right? People with issues have a romance with death. It's called depression, right? So you get that element in there, plainly to see, but when you actually go between the lines and read it, and you try to put yourself in a perspective of the band, right, who was ever writing those lyrics down, probably Jerry Cantrell, possibly Layne Staley, from their perspective, what are they singing about? What I think that song is about is a band that has come to its peak of fame, right, and now they're looking at the road ahead, and doing it with the memory, with the knowledge of the bands that they grew up listening to. Take Led Zeppelin, for example, right? Because Alice in Chains, those guys are my age. They're literally, we're all born like in 1967, right? We're all that same age, so their experience with music is the same as it has been with mine in my life, right? Bands that were big in the 70s, and I mean huge, into the 80s and especially in the 90s, they were literally referred to as the dinosaur acts, right? They were just these big old cumbersome lumbering things from the ancient past. And here you have this young band, not childhood young, mid-20s, right? Mid to late 20s at that stage. I'd say mid, yeah. You could say mid to late 20s. That works. Looking at themselves, where they are with their fame, their popularity, they had just broken through and they had just completed, or they were in the process of completing what would be their quintessential work, right? This LP called Dirt. And they could just see off in the future that everything that was happening now would not be the same. They were already on that downhill trajectory. And they too were going to end up like the Led Zeppelins and the Who's and the Fleetwood Macs and all those huge bands from the 70s that were dinosaurs. We all get old, and that's the point. And they're going to end up being just an old pile of them bones, just like all the bands before them. And that's what I really think that song is speaking to, right? So there's them bones, and then keeping with music momentarily here. Tom Waits, around the same time, possibly the same year, right? Tom Waits released an LP called Bone Machine, and I got that one hot off the presses. I was a big Tom Waits fan, right? And that one came out, and I got it. And when I got it, I didn't know what the hell Bone Machine was. I'm looking at the album, I'm listening to it, thinking, what the hell is a bone machine, right? The first thing comes to my mind as a stoner, I was already sober and clean by then, but I had a prehistory of heavy involvement with drug abuse. First thing that comes to my mind is bone, just like I was saying before, with the marijuana cigarettes, a bone machine. Maybe this is something to do with like a machine that rolls your bones for you, right? Rolls them joints for you. So you don't have to twist them up yourself. I don't know. I never really thought of Tom Waits as like a pothead, as a stivic. He never appealed to me as that kind of person. But All right, that's the first thing I thought. And then when you start listening to the album, I think its lead-in song is called Dirt in the Ground. If that ain't the lead-in, it's one of them, right? It's one of the first two, probably. And there's this song about dirt in the ground, and that has to do about, you know, we're all going to be dirt in the ground, no matter what you do, right? It's very ecclesiastic, thematically, right? Like the writings of Solomon in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. It's got that same kind of lyrical tone to it, that same theme where no matter what you do, you're just going to end up dead in the ground, right? So I'm thinking, okay, Bone Machine, now you've got this song. And what I'm starting to see now is this image of like the entire earth. It just spins around itself on its axis, and then it spins around in its orbit around the sun. And it's doing all this moving and all this churning. And then everything that is born dies. And it just leaves the bones behind. And it's just like this bone machine. You see what I'm saying? That the planet Earth is just like this churning thing that just creates bones, right? That's the imagery I come up with after listening to a song or two and trying to figure out what the hell this title is all about, the Bone Machine, right? And let me say, Tom Waits won like a Grammy in alternative music that year for this album. It was a very good album. But as the times were and as the times dictated, it was kind of depressing, right? It was kind of on that down low. It had that tone. It had that kind of that suck to it that just drew you to your grave, right? So much of the music was like that at that time. And I guess, not surprisingly, Tom Waits also. He's a different bird completely than any of the grunge people. And I never heard any of the grunge people refer to him as like their major influence, right? So they were worlds apart. But this album that he made was very timely. It just turned out to be that way. And it was, it's one of my favorite Tom Waits albums. You know, if I had to pick my top five Tom Waits albums, it's definitely, that's one of them, right, for sure. Where in order it falls, probably variable depending on my mood. But that's a very solid album. He did well in the 90s as far as I'm concerned. His best stuff, really. But what the Bone Machine ends up being, and I found out, even back then, I knew back then, but not initially, you know, after reading some magazine articles, because there was no internet back then, right? Whatever you could find about Tom Waits before there was an internet. The Bone Machine is a reference to this instrument that Tom Waits concocted in like his home studio or something. And it was just a bunch of things, mostly percussive, as I understand it. Things that you can just clank on. Maybe like a frying pan. Maybe like a broken garbage can lid. Just all this stuff kind of like hanging on this framework. And it might have been like horns, like clown horns. You can squeeze a rubber ball on the end. All that. But he called this thing the Bone Machine, right? This contraption. And he would create rhythms on it, right? And I guess some of the songs contain rhythms using this quote-unquote bone machine. So, with all my sophomoric thinking about what a bone machine may be, what my deep philosophical thinking about what a bone machine may be, it turns out that it's just this kind of funky rhythmic instrument that Tom Waits created for recording purposes. That's what the Bone Machine is, huh? Let's see, what else about bones? How about like the skull and the crossbones, right? The pirate flag called the Jolly Roger. The pirate flag called the Jolly Roger. Now, I recall reading something about the origins of this. And, you know, when I laid out some notes, I didn't bother to get into it because I figured it would just come to me, but it hasn't. I don't remember where this pirate flag originated out of. So I'm going to try to pull it together here right quick and get something to go with. The Jolly Roger is the traditional English name for the naval ensign flown to identify a pirate ship preceding or during an attack during the early 18th century, which was the latter part of the golden age of piracy, right? Believe me, if they think that that shit was the golden age of piracy, they ain't seen nothing like the piracy we're seeing in the modern era. Just think 9/11 and the piracy occurred with that. Everything has been piracy. Believe me. But that's another story. I've told some of it before. I'll tell some of it again. But not right now. Right? Let's see. The vast majority of such flags flew the motif of a human skull or death's head, often accompanied by other elements on a black, dark brown, or dark blue field, sometimes called the death's head flag or just the black flag. The flag most commonly identified as the Jolly Roger today, the skull and crossbones symbol on a black flag, was used during the 1710s by a number of pirate captains, including Black Sam Bellamy, Edward England, and John Taylor. I know nothing of any of those guys, so don't ask. It became the most commonly used pirate flag during the 1720s, although other designs were also in use. The origins of the name Jolly Roger are kind of scatterbrained. It is sometimes claimed that the term derives from Jolly Rouge, pretty red, in reference to a red flag used by French privateers. But I do not see any kind of definitive origin of the phrase Jolly Roger at all. It's the skull and crossbones flag of the pirates of the era in the 1700s into the 1800s, probably late 1600s as well. But the piracy continues. Now, then we're not flying a Jolly Roger flag. The piracy that continues now is, for one really good, obvious example, secret society. I've mentioned this before, out of Yale University called the Skull and Bones, right? They are literally taking the imagery from the pirate flag, attributing it to their secret society. And the secret society is made up of who? Elite people, right? The business elite, the corporate elite, the probably legal elite, political elite, financial elite. These are the children of the elite class of people in this country. They all go to this school, and many of them belong to this secret society, which equates itself with piracy. So you kind of get an idea of the mentality of the elite in this world, in that secret society, and probably others, because they compete at the same things. Their idea is to do what pirates do. What's that? Steal the treasure of others. And I connect these people to Britain as loyalists. I spoke much about that in the previous three episodes. I'm not going to get into it all now. But I look at these people as actual British pirate loyalists in this country, taking the wealth and doing a massive wealth transfer out of this country into England, to the Rothschilds, to Europe, just out of here, right? Raping the Statue of Liberty is another way of looking at it. But yeah, they got this secret society in Yale. It goes to this day. It goes all the way back like 200 years, maybe a little bit more than that. It's had presidents. In fact, two Bush presidents, both of them were skull and crossbones. John Kerry, that Frankenstein-looking dude, you know, Mr. World Economic Forum, Mr. Climate Change, that freakazoid, you know. He was skull and crossbones. Other presidents were skull and crossbones. The Bush's senator father was skull and crossbones. The grandfather, you know, you had the Herbert, Walker, Prescott's, and all these different lines of ancestry tied to the Bushes. They're all part of skull and bones, right? The secret society in Yale up in Connecticut. So you got that. You got the rolling bones, right? Rolling bones. It's a dice. You got to roll them bones. It's a way of describing the dice you use for gambling and gaming in general. I have to imagine that originally, before the use of plastics in this world, they would make dice out of bones, cut them into cubes and label them and number them. So yeah, you got the bones that you roll bones to smoke and you roll bones to gamble, right? My thoughts on gambling, probably not what you would expect. Having had been given some idea about my background and everything, I'm indifferent is probably the single best word to put it. I'm indifferent about gambling. I have thoughts, I have concerns. On the one hand, I like the idea of being able to go and just make a quick buck, you know, at risk, at my own risk. More often than not, it's a foolish proposition. But if in a desperate moment, I wouldn't mind taking my last dollar and trying to turn it into two really quick, you know. The way I approach gambling is if I have an extra $100, $200 just to burn, I might piss away on something stupid otherwise, you know. Something like, you know, a knife when I don't need another knife. Well, instead of spending $100 on a knife, go, lay it on the roulette, you know, just put $100 on black and see if you can come out with a $200, right? That's how I'd gamble. And then if I won, then I'd gamble on the house money. And you get what you get, you know? Me, I would go play blackjack, and that's where I'd get killed. I know the game, and I generally do well with it, but at a casino, hell no. No way. They just absorb the house money right out of you. But on the slots, you could get lucky. You know, you can get lucky and get a couple extra $100. You just have to have the patience to sit there and plug quarters away for hours, right? And you know, part of the problem is that environment. Being in a casino for any extended period of time. Extended period of time to me is like more than an hour. Seriously, I mean to get in and out if I ever do that. I don't like hanging around that place. I get a headache. There is obviously something immoral involved with gambling. It's in the line of sin that I would categorize as greed, right? Greed and covetousness, those areas. And I don't get that, see, because I'm not a money guy. I'm not a greed guy. I feel really good about, like, giving a homeless person $20, and I don't feel so good about spending $20 on fried chicken. You know what I'm saying? I like fried chicken. But the feeling I get, you know, with generosity versus indulgence, you know, I think of things in the Old West. And I'm going to go to the Old West. Now I'm going to go all the way to Vegas before I'm done talking about gambling. And it's not going to be very long, right? Just a little snippet, just because we're talking about rolling them bones, right? The tumbling dice, all that. We had in the history of our country, right, the biography of the United States, a couple of episodes of gold mining bonanzas. And with that, you had this thing called gold fever, right? People get this gold fever. And I've seen, like, examples of it in Westerns and things. People just get nuts about striking it rich, right? And I don't get that insanity because I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not that money guy. My inclinations towards immorality and sin were never down those lines of the money thing, right? So I don't get it. I don't get it. But it was a reality. It is a reality. People get that goal, the gold fever, and you could translate that into the casino life and the gambling just in general. Because, see, people get sick. You know, they become, really, it's a moral corruption that occurs to people. And the insanity is just like at skin level. You could see it on a person. You could see a person losing it. I remember, you know, I just got this really strange memory shoot through my soul here. There was a sitcom in the 80s. What the hell was it called? It was the one with Michael J. Fox, right? Alex P. Keaton. Family Ties. Family Ties, right? And you had that goofy Stivic of a hippie, spent hippie father who's just so, like, placid and dickless. I couldn't take that guy, right? I couldn't take that guy, but Alex P. Keaton's character was interesting. His sister, the older sister, was interesting. The mother was kind of a conundrum because she seemed a little kind of like stiff, obviously a liberal. But there was just one episode I remember seeing because that's the kind of shit that was on TV. You're watching TV, that's, you know, what you get. I probably saw it in reruns. I think my first wife liked that show, if I remember correctly. Now, I may not, but she has grown to be a very nostalgic person, so I don't think she would argue with me over that fact. But I remember an episode where this mother that kind of seemed on the straight and narrow in general ended up in a casino somehow and, like, lost her ever-loving mind. She just fell right in with the whole degeneracy of gambling. You know, that whole, but what people call like an addiction, that whole addictive quality to it. And just one more, just one more roll, just one more pull at a slot, just, you know, one more. And like, I've never been anywhere close to that, right? Never been anywhere close to understanding that in gambling. I've been that way with drugs and alcohol, right? But not with the gambling. It's just an odd memory that just popped into my head about it. I use that word degenerate, right? Another thing, The Sopranos, which I speak about here and there throughout my episodes, right? My ties back to New Jersey, to North Jersey. The Sopranos frequently dealt with gamblers, right? They would lend money out. They would put their money out on the street. And most of the people taking that money would be gamblers that wanted to go out and try to make it big. And, the mafia profited handsomely off of guys like that, especially when they had collateral. Like, one example was there was a guy who owned a sporting goods store, right? He had a gambling problem, and he got in over his head taking money from the mafia, from Tony Soprano and the boys. Ends up losing his store. In a lot of cases, it's the mafia that will take over a store like that, right? So that's how they get into legitimate business. But then, of course, they find ways to take the legitimate business, run it to the ground for illegitimate money. It's just what they do, right? But the thing about The Sopranos is every time, you know, you have all these characters or mafia guys, and they're running around, they're on drugs, and they're killing people, and they're extorting, and they're doing all this bad stuff. They're cheating on their wives, right? They're hitting wives and beating girlfriends, and they live a completely immoral lifestyle. But when it comes to gamblers, they all look down their nose at gamblers. That damn degenerate gambler. You know, like, it's a lesser form of being than even they are, right? Which is always funny to me, and it's probably meant to be funny, but there's probably some degree of truth to it all. Like, I don't know. I never really ran with that crowd, kind of rub elbows, but never was in, you know, and I didn't want to be in. But yeah, the Sopranos with their degenerate gamblers. I think of gamblers, I think of Tom Waits has a song, an album from 1980, Heart Attack and Vine. Really good album. I like the album. In fact, that album has the original version of Jersey Girl on it, the song that Bruce Springsteen co-opted, right? Made part of his universe. I'm not a Springsteen fan at all. I've spoken about that at some length. Don't get me started. Bruce Springsteen wishes he was Tom Waits and will never be, right? Tom Waits wrote the song, and the original version of it appears on this album, Heart Attack in Mind. But that's not the song that I have in mind, right? The song that I have in mind is one that's called Mr. Siegel. Obviously, apparently, a reference to Bugsy Siegel, who had involvement with the establishment of Las Vegas as a big-time gambling town, right? The whole song, going through the lyrics, is about a guy who's just like on a typical immoral Las Vegas run. Spending time in whorehouses, drunk, and just getting into trouble, living the debauchery of it all. And there's a line in it, right? There's a lot of good lines. Tom Waits has great lyrics. Just an excellent writer. You don't even need to have the music. You could just go with the words with this guy. He tells such a great story. He paints such a great picture. You know, one of my all-time favorites, probably my longest running of my all-time favorites. I go all the way back to about the time of this album. Really, it was the album that came a year later. Was the first one I ever heard, but this was the second one I ever heard. And I was kind of like right up to speed with him at that point. So it goes all the way back. But here's this lyric I'm talking about. Now, this is Vegas, right? This is a guy in Las Vegas on the Strip. It would have been in the 1970s, you know, late 70s. I dropped 30 grand on the Nugget slots and had to sell my ass on Fremont Street, right? Of all the great lyrics in this song, why do I pull that one out? I pull that one out because when you're living a degenerate gambler lifestyle, on the way to your untimely end, you're going to visit places like this where you have to, quote unquote, sell your ass, right? More often than not, that's a woman thing, but, you know, men end up in that dumpster having to suck dick too because of the trouble that they get into and the desperation they have for money, right? And so anything that leads you on a line that's going to make you stop and visit that scene of your life is a bad line to be on, right? Here's your warning. Here's your sign. Here's the red flag, you know, on the situation. If you start into a life of gambling on a routine basis, understand that somewhere down the road, you're probably going to be behind a dumpster sucking dick, all right? And the same goes with the drugs and the drinking and all that stuff. These are lifestyles that lead down that path that brings you to that place. And that's not the end of it all. It goes on and gets worse from there, believe it or not. But if it brings you there, that's a bad way to go. And that's all I got to say about that. So gambling is basically a bad thing. But I don't have a problem with it existing. I would say keep it classy, but that's impossible because some people are classy and some people are not. It is what it is. Now, I've noticed out west, and it's not this way in Texas, but in a lot of the states out in the Great West here in the United States, gambling is kind of a very common thing. Nevada, where Las Vegas is, of course, right? But other states too. I remember I spent some time up in Montana. They just got little casinos everywhere. You could just go in and play the slots and things like that. It's not fancy casinos, but they're just all over the place, and gambling is a part of life for people. You go into a bar, they'll have slot machines somewhere in the back. You know, it's not that big a deal. It's not that big a deal, and it doesn't seem to be that big a problem for people. You know, one person out of ever so many of them really get caught up in it and get stupid about it. But generally speaking, it doesn't concern me, and I like the option, you know. And when you make up a casino with a touch of class and you can get yourself a good meal and a good show and all that, what the hell's wrong with that? I don't do it, but what's wrong with it? There's really nothing wrong with it, I don't think. As far as morals go, most anything that you can do that is immoral is not really all that bad in moderation. But so many of these things that you might do in moderation perpetuate very quickly and replace God at the center of your being. And this is where all the troubles start. But anyway, that's what I think about gambling. Not that it's important or anything, but that's kind of where we're at. And I'm happy to say I never had to sell my ass on Fremont Street or any other street. Stick around for part two, okay?
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00074, Bones of Contention, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning in to Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.
Yeah.